Go Loud presents Murder Most Irish. Find it first on the Go Loud app and on all major podcast platforms.
Funny what you sent me today, that thing that they're all reposting.
Oh, fucking honestly, I'm gonna say this on this is going out on the real podcast, right, not on the Patreon. Yeah. Why your family members in real time, watching them in real time and understanding that they're thick as fuck,
oh god,
is not, it's not pleasant. I was sitting at work and my sister put up that thing of like, I don't give meta. Like, this thing they're all fucking screen grabbing where they're like, I'm like, what are they talking? I was like, what is this nonsense? I'm going to read it out.
What they put every up. Now and again. You know who else reposted that after you sent it to me?
My mother.
Poor Winona Ryder.
Like, goodbye, Meta AI. Please note an attorney has advised us to put this on. Failure to do so may result in legal consequences. As Meta is now a public entity, all members must post a similar statement. If you do not post at least once, it will be assumed you're okay with using your information and photos. I do not give Meta or anyone else permission to use any of my personal data, profiles, or information or photos. Can I just say, when I say you're thick, what do you think is happening with this? Who do you think?
So the font that's used is killing me. It looks like they're saying like happy birthday or something. Yeah. It's so funny.
Like, who do you think in Meta is sitting down? Like, I'm just like, do you not think before you repost it? Are you not reading things to be like, that doesn't make sense?
I think it becomes like a hive mind thing where they all start posting it for some reason. And it's really, I have something on my lip. Oh, the pen is on my lip.
Family chat and was like, these are all a bunch of idiots.
But my mom, I got pen on my lip. My mom was reading something off her phone earlier and it was, you know, Enoch Burke's brother.
Yes.
Paid for this advertisement about how he's being treated badly because of his religious beliefs, and he had all the things he's done in his life and how much money he has and how important and smart he has. And she was reading this off and I was like, where are you reading this from? She was like, Facebook, it's on Facebook, it must be on the news. So I took it off her and I was like, mom, this is a fucking paid ad. He has paid to put this on Facebook. None of this is true. So I just blocked it immediately from her thing because, like, dude, honestly, watching grown people be dragged into literal fake news.
And also, Emma, he hasn't paid for that himself. Someone's backed him.
Yeah, fully. And it's probably some cunt in England or America who's like, we don't like the trans.
Yeah, no, actually,
USA. One of those people.
My pronouns are the United States of America.
My pronouns are kiss my ass.
Yeah, no, I've seen he put up a video where he's looking for inclusion by the Justice Minister of Helen McEntee because he's being excluded from, I think it's something to do with his law degree. And I put it up on Twitter and I was like, because he's asking for inclusion. And then immediately he's like, I should be included. I'm entitled to my free beliefs and my rights and my religious beliefs. And then he immediately is like, and I believe that trans people are wrong and they shouldn't exist and that's my right. And I literally put up on Twitter being like, asking for inclusion whilst immediately then spouting exclusion. Yep. Is what, like, you, like,
they are so myopic, they can't see past, like, what they're saying.
I was like, there's a lesson in there, you should really learn it. Like, yeah. Honest to God. And he's standing on the side of the street and he's like, I should be included. And then literally the next sentence is, my brother is in prison because he believes that trans people shouldn't exist. And I believe they shouldn't exist. And I believe they're wrong in my religion and I'm entitled to my right. So I still should be included. And it's like, your brother is standing outside of school and refused to teach a person who wasn't even in class and treat that people with the that person with the respect they deserve and ask for, to be like, my pronouns are this. My brother, your brother is essentially denying that person inclusion, yeah. And you're now feeling the consequences of that.
Like, and he's in jail because he harassed the school and then was told not to go to the school, and he continued to go to the school and he went to jail. He's not in jail because he said, I don't like trans people. He's in jail for harassment and consistently breaking the law. That's why he's in jail.
He keeps breaking a public order.
Say whatever you want. You can say whatever you want. And that's a fact of life. You can stand on the street and say, I hate trans people. What you will do is deal with the consequences of it.
It's just like, this is the most nonsense. And to be like, those people, that family, smart and being brainwashed are two different things.
Exactly.
But they're all incredibly intelligent. They all have incredibly academic backgrounds. Like, so they're capable of, like, withholding large amounts of information and repurposing it and putting it to, like, what could be considered good use, depending on what they're doing. But, like, this, their inability to be like, yeah, I don't believe trans people should exist and that's my right, to then be like, so I should be included in this. Like, I think it's the law, like, it's not like a union, but it's like, you know, when you're a member of the law society. Yeah. And they've essentially said, like, we don't want you. Like, we don't want you. You don't represent our values.
You don't represent our values. Because if you want to remove somebody for their values from your line of thinking and your life, it's going to be done back to you, buddy. You don't get it both ways. Like, you don't. Like, and the thing about it is, some of the biggest bigots in the world are some of the smartest people you will ever meet. Like, people think intelligence equals, you know, inclusion, no bigotry, no racism. Some of the smartest people in the world are the biggest bigots you could ever meet in your life, and they will utilize their intelligence to be bigger bigots. It doesn't matter. Like, you know, it's incredibly easy to say, oh, everybody that's racist is dumb. No, academically speaking, they're not.
No, that's it. And like, the people who are running Trump's campaign, they're not, like, dumb.
They're smart. They're very, very fucking smart, unfortunately. Yeah. Also, Sarah, I hate saying this, but I'm pretty sure he's going to lose.
He's going to lose.
Yeah, because you hear what he said the other day. He was like, if I lose, I won't run again.
Yeah. And he's not, he knows it's coming.
Yeah, he knows it's coming. And then, did you see that Republican candidate? I'm not sure what state it's in. That guy, Mark Robinson.
Is that the black guy?
A black Nazi guy?
Yeah. He's the guy that
crazy.
He's the guy that Trump has been on stage at, like, every rally, being like, that guy's he's the next Martin Luther King.
He's the new Martin Luther King, and he's online being like, I'm a black Nazi, and I like to piss on people. And he said he doesn't like trans people and doesn't agree with trans people. And then was online being like, I love trans porn.
I like trans porn.
Yeah.
He didn't call it that. I'm being respectful on what he called it, because that's not what he called it. But that guy's that man has. Did you see when he was at the rally and he was talking about the Latin music star, and he was like, we love her, she's so sexy, she's here tonight, and it was a man.
No.
Yeah, it was a man.
So embarrassing. I think people are starting to see how embarrassing they are. It's almost like a veil has slightly been lifted, because I've seen a lot of Republicans being like,
Republicans are like,
bigger Republicans today saying that they're going to lose if Donald, it's the same thing with Biden, they're going to lose if they keep pushing Donald Trump as their candidate.
They've got less than 90 days to the election.
Like, I'm hopeful that he's not going to win. I'm hopeful. But just from what I'm looking at, it seems some sort of veil has been lifted and people are like, no, we're not doing this again.
I think the veil that's been lifted is just that they're aware that people aren't going to. I don't think it's any like anything where they've learned their lesson.
No.
I think it's that the character and the character and the politics, previously the character was like what people were like, the character, like my dad will be like, Trump is so funny, like he's gassed, you know, like my dad would be like, what a funny guy.
Yeah.
And my dad is an idiot. Do you know what I mean? So my dad would be like, I think we should vote for him because he's hilarious, because he doesn't. My dad has no understanding of like what consequences, because he's a privileged white man. Like, do you know what I mean? And my dad's never been anywhere. He doesn't pay attention to anything.
Yeah.
He's not So, and I think what's happened now is that there isn't enough guys like my dad willing to vote for him. And yeah. I think there that the guys that, and he's also like, you know, he's done so much damage. Like Roe v. Wade has more consequences for people.
Republicans as well. He thought that that could happen and there wouldn't be Republican women being like, oh, fucked my neighbor. I'm pregnant. Gotta get an abortion. Can't get one.
Yeah. The Roe v. Wade thing in particular, I think, is really the thing that's like what she's doing really well on, because after the last debate, which he won't do another one now, people were absolutely convinced that she was going to go up significantly in the points, mm-hmm. and she didn't. She went up marginally in the swing states by like 1 or 2 points, which again is pretty much like we're neck and neck.
Neck and neck, yeah.
But where she's doing well and where you want to win is people who are undecided. That's where you're looking. You're like, people who are undecided is who you want to swing, because other people who have like looked at their candidates are Republicans or they're Democrats and they're going to vote one way or the other. That's really it. There's no independents left anymore. Oh, what's his face dropped out? So they don't have that to worry about. So now what people are focusing on is the undecided. And the undecided, where she does well, is all around Roe v. Wade. It's all around female healthcare and reproductive healthcare. Where she's doing poorly is that people like that she's getting a lot of like stuff in the polls where it's like, I don't know enough about her. And the policy stuff, she hasn't really talked about the economy. When they talked, the first question of the debate was about economy, and she really didn't get to have a chance to talk because Trump just went down the route of talking about immigration.
Yeah. But also I saw today that one of the biggest police unions in the United States is backing her. So this is why I start thinking, listen, also, can I just say fuck Kamala Harris? We're not sitting here going, yay, Kamala. Like, I don't girl boss for war criminals.
No.
I don't make T-shirts of war criminals. This is the same fucking shit when Hillary Clinton was running and everybody was just ignoring all the terrible, awful things her and her family have done. To be like, girl boss feminism is dead. Put it in the ground and leave it there. I'm done with this fucking bullshit. You can't girl boss war criminals. Stop it. You can say what you need to say without being like, oh my God, girl power. You're embarrassing everybody.
Yeah, no, you are. And I think the point has to be made that me sitting here, because obviously I'm like, people in work are always like, you're obsessed with American politics. And I'm like, it's really important. It has long, stretched, wide effects on the rest of the world.
Look what's happening in Gaza.
Yeah, I was like, it genuinely affects every part of society. And I hate to say that, but that is the truth. I was like,
imperialism is a very real thing. And we are in an imperialist society. These fuckers, I've always said it, when America sneezes, the world catches the flu. It's deeply fucking frustrating. It isn't the way it should be. But unfortunately, for now, while it is like that, we have to care.
Yeah, and that's the thing. And you're playing in a two-party system. And the other thing I said to somebody the other day, they were like, you know, talking about, I was like, Kamala is the one you're going to vote for. That's, if I was in the States, Kamala's the one I'm voting for. I was like, but would I want to vote for her? No. If I had another option, would I vote for somebody else? But also, if you vote the other way, fascism wins. Yeah, and at least with Kamala, I was like, at least in some sense, she's listening to people and doing some things about the things that she thinks that she is doing some things that are positive and listening to people. And he was like, and I was like, I'm not ignoring Gaza, I'm not ignoring Palestine. But you're also talking about a country where there are certain swing states that are completely ran by essentially Jewish states. And I was like, they will make or break an election.
People keep saying, why isn't she speaking up? I'm like, A, she's not speaking up because she agrees with what's happening. Let's get that straight.
Yeah.
She fully agrees with what's happening in Palestine at the moment. Let's get that straight. Most highly ranked American politicians do. The second thing she's doing is she's going, I don't want to lose not even the Jewish vote, I don't want to lose the Zionist vote. And unfortunately, the poor decent Jewish people who are like, hey, this is genocide and a massacre, are not being listened to. But she doesn't care, because the Zionists are pumping money into the United States. It's so simple of an equation to understand why she's not speaking on it. First and foremost, obviously, as I said, being she does not fucking care.
No, she doesn't.
None of them care. They don't there. They will have these children slaughtered, murdered, massacred. They'll find bombs and murder these kids, and they'll still get on stage and be like, "Girl power." Like, it's so frustrating.
Yeah, yeah, no, it's really frustrating.
But I understand that people don't want to vote for Trump. I get it.
No, and I think I just feel sorry for, I feel sorry for Americans. I feel sorry for loads of states at the minute that have, like, Keir Starmer's on stage saying, "Free the sausages." Kill yourself. Do us a favor. Kill yourself.
Also, could you, I know we live in a country that we have a lot of problems, right? We do. But could you imagine living in a country where every 4 years you're like, "Oh my God, here we go." Like, every 4 years.
Yeah. No, the like.
Every 2 years into that 4 years, it begins.
Yeah, no, the like, you get president for 2 years, and then the next 2 years are just you rerunning or getting
like, rid of money. I'll be president again, or I'm not doing this. Like, yeah. I just feel for, I feel for the people of the United States, because literally they are in a country that does not care about them, A, doesn't give a fuck about its citizens, and B, the levelings of anxiety and stress they must feel every 4 years. It's just insane. But it all, every 4 years here.
No, God, but could you imagine as well how, like, it makes their polarizing two-party system even more polarizing.
And that's because, the thing, that's what they depend on. They depend on the polarization. On it, like, the people fighting each other constantly. This is how their politics thrive. You're the worst. No, you're the worst. No, you're the worst. And in the meantime, women are losing reproductive rights.
Yeah, in the meantime, women are losing reproductive
rights. And chattel slavery is back in prisons.
Yeah.
Like, they're in hell. Anyway, we're going there in March, everybody. So
yeah, I would love for Colin just to put together an entire episode of just all of our rants about America.
America, and then pictures of us in the States, like,
yeah. Pictures of me in Disney World.
Yeah.
With my Mickey Mouse ears on. Hey, look at me, the hypocrite.
Filthy fucking hypocrites, the two of us.
No, honestly. Here, look what I got in Disney World, because I just...
That's so cute, dude.
For anybody who's listening, I'm holding up. I got a pin that's the grape
screenshot. Let me take a screenshot. Hold on.
The grape soda from Up.
I took a screenshot. That's so fucking cute.
Isn't that cute?
I love that.
It's really heavy, but it's a really heavy pin. I don't know where you'd be able to stick it without losing it.
Did you put it on that? Oh, put it on a coat.
I put it in my jewellery box, because genuinely, also, I will say about Disney World, they do this whole pin exchange thing, and it's actually lovely and cute.
What is it?
So, people collect pins. They make, like, there's shops that just sell pins in Disney World and Disneyland, and then you're allowed to go around and swap, I think, one pin a day, and they leave, like, in every shop, there's, like, a pin, like, place, and people go in and swap, so people just leave their pins and swap.
Cute. And
also, they trade pins, so there's a place in Epcot called The Pin Trader, I think it's what it's called, and people come to, like, Epcot, and they sit outside, and they've got, like, all of their pins, and people, like, trade them. It's actually, like, one of the more wholesome, cute things that...
Sorry, that's fucking adorable.
Yeah, it gets to happen in Disney World.
Cutest thing.
Being in Disney World is great, because see all this ranting that I do, that doesn't happen in Disney World, because you're not a member of society.
No, you're absolutely cut off. You don't even feel like you're in America. You just feel like you're in Disney. Like, they've done that on purpose, obviously, you know?
Yeah, no.
Anyway, shout out to America. I hope you're okay. It's a shit show. I can't imagine the level of anxiety and stress that women and people of color and indigenous people feel in that country every fucking 4 years. But like, hey, am I going to wake up tomorrow and be banned from existing?
Yeah, hey, am I going to wake up tomorrow and have access to this medication? Because all of a sudden, like, I was watching a documentary tonight about, like, the medical system in America and patents and how they get to charge such money. So, like, you know the way an inhaler here is, like, I don't know, like, less than 20 quid. I can get an inhaler on prescription for, like, 13 euro for Lily's asthma. An inhaler in the States is like $400.
Insanity. That's just.
And I was like, try and figure out how they, like, charge that, because it's the same thing, right? Like, it's the same thing. The medication is the same.
That's the thing, yeah.
And how they do it is the patents aren't generally on the medication. They put them on, like, on the inhalers, for example, they've put the patent on the cap or the sleeve or the, like, thing they hold it with. And once they've got the patent on it, then they send you it. That's when it becomes they can charge whatever they want because no one else can make it. Now, obviously, there is patents on medication. I'm not saying it doesn't exist, but patents on medication generally have, like, a time. They generally... Yeah. Can't yeah. be forever. They just, so the how they do in the States to get around that is they essentially repackage or remake things, but it's the exact same thing, but they then patent the one thing that's changed on it. So they then continue to charge that amount of money on it. Isn't that insane? Like, isn't that capitalism on steroids?
They're just killing people. Oh my God, man, I don't even know. They're just killing their citizens, and then they're fucking crying about communism. Why do you listen to yourself? Anyway, you know what? Well, shout out to America. I hope you're okay. Like, as fuck.
Also,
man,
I would like to notify everybody that me and Emma are going to New York. So
we are in March.
We are going in March. So why I'm telling you all now is be prepared for the lives.
No, I will be good this time. I will have manners. No. There will be no lives.
The lives were like the best thing about the last time we went.
I will try not be a fucking drunken whore the entire. Well, I won't be a whore, but a drunken man.
How long it's been since we've been there?
In ages.
So unlike us.
So unlike us. Well, I haven't had a job, so.
You fucking bum.
I am a bum. As I say to Sarah, your unemployed friend on a Tuesday. That's
me. Oh, how are you getting on with Slow Horses?
I've watched the first two episodes. I really like it.
Stick with
it. I'm gonna stick with it. I really, really like it. Apparently there's a new show that I want to start. Gone out of my head. Never mind. Forget this conversation. I don't remember what it's called. It's apparently akin to Succession. It's like Succession. It's on HBO. Nope, can't remember.
Anyway, Succession.
It's a black creator. Anyway, whatever. You'll know what I'm talking about. Yes.
Shows of all time.
Succession. Have you any housekeeping?
Housekeeping?
Yeah. No, I don't have any housekeeping. I'm sorry to anybody that follows us on Twitter because I've just been harassing people on it and I apologize.
I got suspended from Instagram.
I don't think you can get suspended from Twitter because Elon Musk.
When I asked Instagram why I'm suspended, they said because I was selling stuff. So Sarah Jane and Colin keep saying I was selling my flaps. I was not selling my flaps or any part of my body. But I wish I was, because it would have made sense then that I got suspended. But they said I was selling something. And then Colin told me the Phoenix Park page that they created got suspended for selling tickets to the gig on their thing. So I'm thinking maybe it's because I've been talking about that. I don't know.
But we sell tickets on our podcast page.
I have no idea. They were like, you've been selling and or something. I'm like, what the fuck are you doing? And I said, I wish I was selling something, i.e. my boobs. But I wasn't selling my boobs and or flaps. So I don't know. They said they're going to be like, look at it and see if they'll give me my page back. But kind of part of me is like, just keep it. Just keep it.
Yeah.
Like, I kind of, part of me is like, I don't want to do this anymore. I'll use the MMI one for our stuff and then that's it. I need to get the book off the internet.
Yeah, no, it's good to be off it. That's the one thing about me. I'm not on the internet. Like, anybody that follows me on TikTok, you'll know when I'm not at work.
Like, hey guys, I did a shit.
I make like 4 ridiculous, nonsensical, stupid videos a day. And that then when I'm at work, I make like 1 a month.
Yeah, no, I think maybe it's better that they keep it. Because then it gives me no excuse to restart it. So I think I just let them keep it. And then I just use the MMI one for us.
Snooping.
That's it. I should probably tell people what this episode is. Hello. So this isn't going to be a regular episode. This week, I am interviewing the lovely Scott Crawford, who directed Salad Days, which is the movie I'm putting on the Sugar Club in October.
Salads.
Unfortunately, Scott lives in America and he is 6 hours behind us, so we can't record tonight until probably midnight, and I'm not going to expect Sarah Jane to stay awake until midnight to record a podcast because she has what a job.
I'm so really sorry that the beginning of this podcast is just us ragging on the States, and now we're like, hey Scott,
hey Scott, hey, Scott, what's going on? So, yeah, I'm going to just interview Scott. We're going to talk about the movie, probably a few other bits and bobs. If you're not interested in that, it's totally OK. You can just skip to the end where there's going to be nothing else.
A song.
The song at the end. But yeah, so that's what this week's episode is. I hope you all enjoy it. I hope I did an OK job talking to him. It could be a mess. We'll find out.
What questions are you going to ask?
I have a list of questions here. I have stuff written out. Here, look.
So, oh, look at this.
Yeah, so I've stuff written out. Also, I'll tell you when we finish recording this about the other thing. About the other thing that we're doing. I'll tell you when we're finished recording this. Yeah, so that's what this week's episode is. Scott is such a nice guy. He's really interesting. He's led an incredibly interesting life. Like, insanely cool life. So yeah, that's what we're going to do this week. And I just feel bad because I don't want Sarah to think that I'm trying to do an episode without her. That's not what's happening. I'm sorry to everybody.
I'd love it. Actually, I would. When I tell you, I would add no value to the next thing that's about to happen on this podcast. I cannot say.
Yes, Emma, you would.
When I tell you, the other day when I was coming down, I Googled top 10 questions.
To ask a man about a thing.
I was like, top 10 questions. I was like, so what interested you in this thing?
You like music, eh?
So,
I hear you like bands.
I hear you're into the music and you like to make movies about
movies? Well, tell us about that. That's probably what it's going to be like with me, because I'm really nervous.
And then I do this at the end of every question. Mm-hmm. Brave choice. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Just like, can you elaborate on that? Because I don't have anything else to ask you. So just elaborate on that.
Real brave choice.
But yeah, I hope you guys enjoy it. If you don't, I apologize. We'll be back to normal next week.
It's going to be great and it will be lovely and it will be enjoyable and you need to chill the fuck out. And it's probably the only podcast episode of ours that I'm ever going to listen to because I'm not on it.
But yeah, we'll be back as regular scheduled programming next week. I will do a case again, Sarah. I know you're on work and you're very busy, so I'll work out a case. We'll do that and hooray.
Hooray, hooray. I have to do something. I haven't done anything and I'm very sorry.
For next week, when you're less mental in work.
You are very good. You're much better at the cases than me. This is
don't do that. Actually, you know whose hair you have? You have Annie Potts' hair.
Who?
Annie Potts. Yeah.
I love her.
I love Annie Potts.
That's the greatest and nicest thing you've ever said to me.
You've got Annie Potts' hair. That's what hair you have. Mm-mm-mm. And I love Annie Potts. She is amazing. And she still looks amazing.
I love you. She does still looks insane.
Yeah,
she looks beautiful. Like, she has not aged.
No, she looks unreal. I love her.
You're
80.
You know what I was going to say? And I know I sent you a message and you just ignored it, but I am very proud of you.
Oh, thank you.
And I know that you were nervous about doing this evening. You said something to me during the day and it really bothered me. And when I was driving home, I was thinking about it. You said, he's the real deal. And like, why me? And I was like, you're the real deal. You started this podcast with like a wing and a prayer. Do you know what I mean? Like,
without any Harvard referencing.
Yeah, without any Harvard referencing. That would be the other day. Harvard referencing? Me bollocks.
That's our absolute take on this entire podcast is Harvard referencing me bollocks. Oh, we're calling the episode that.
Harvard referencing me bollocks. That man is, I'm going to put the video, I'll send you the video so you can put it up.
Please do. Yeah. It's funny. Harvard referencing, I'm just writing it down.
Me bollocks.
Me bollocks. Also trying to explain to my mother what I'm doing, speaking to Scott, it has been torturous.
Wait, what she said?
She's not getting it. She's not getting it. She's like, what are you doing? I was like, I'm interviewing somebody. Who are you interviewing? Oh, the guy that I'm putting on the movie for. It's not your movie. When do you think I filmed a movie? When do you think that happened?
I love how disconnected our parents are from our actual lives.
I was like, when do you think I filmed it? When? I'm here all the time.
I'm here with you, motherfucker, for the last
year. You. Yeah, she's like, isn't that your film?
Imagine you're like, I've been secretly filming you for the last
year. Filming this bullshit that's currently going on.
You fucking clean in the step at 6 o'clock in the morning.
Fucking nut job. I'm so glad we're not like that, though. That is very much a generational thing.
Oh, the cleaning thing?
The obsessive thing. Don't get me wrong, there's nothing wrong with being hygienic. Hygiene is very important. But this constant upset, like if you're not cleaning, you're dirty.
Yeah, or it's actually, I think it's more just that, like, you're, like, that's the role they taught, that's the role they were brought up to be, like, that's how you add value.
Yeah,
and the thing about it is, that always got me, is, like, you can add value, absolutely, that does add value, you're keeping our house clean and all of that, but you don't need to add value for fucking 24 hours of the day.
Yeah, and, like, you're a whole person
That. And chill the fuck out. Like, I watch Graham's mom and I'm just like, are you, like, Graham's mom must at the end of the day just be like, oh, it's so tired. Like, when I was down with your mom today, and she's all for cancer treatment, so she would be tired, but she also is like, when I'm there, she's like, I'll make you toast, will I make you, like, even when I was coming down, she's like, will I make you bread, will I make, and I'm like, I don't want anything, I just want to sit down and have a cup of tea with you, like, relax.
For coming down, I was like, Sarah doesn't want anything, mom, just wants to down and we go get ham, because I told her you're coming, because if I didn't, she would have been like, why didn't you tell me she was coming? So I did tell her you were coming, because I was like, it's easier. But she immediately started panicking, immediately, within seconds, because it is very much that thing where you have to be like, have you ever seen that Chris Fleming video where he is dressed up like the, like a middle-aged mother, and there's people coming over to the house and he's trying to clean the house?
No,
I'll send you this video. Everybody look up Chris Fleming on YouTube, and it's like the cleaning video. I'll send it to you, because it is literally what, like, living with my mother. Send it to you. Like, it is. So, I love Chris Fleming. Chris Fleming is so funny. But yeah, I'll send it on to you.
Anyway, that's all I've got. That's all you've got. So I hope everybody has a really nice week. Enjoy listening to Emma talk to Scott about his documentary that he's re-releasing and his other documentary that he's currently making. And welcome, Scott.
Hey, Colin, tell us about the Patreon.
Sure thing, Lily Pops. Hey there, MMI fans, it's me, Colin, and do I have news for you. It's all going down over at www.patreon.com/murdermostirish, where we've totally revamped our Patreon offering for you mega fans. That's right, now all of your favourite Patreon stuff can be found in one place as we bring you our MMI Super Show exclusively for Patreon, featuring all the usual banter and chat between Emma and Sarah Jane, plus me thrown into the bargain, along with Lily's Tales, Maximilian's Bailbag, and some surprises along the way. But that's not all. Every single week, due to popular demand, we will be bringing you a full-length story, whether it be Miscellaneous Most Irish for those cases that just don't fit on the main show, Murder Most International for those cases you guys have been crying out for, or even Music Most Awesome, where we talk about our favorite albums. But wait, there's even more! How about MMI Drive, the fan favorite podcast show where Emma and Sarah Jane drive around Dublin talking about all sorts of shite, plus our monthly Ask Me Arse segment, where you get to pick the brains of the girls and maybe even ask me a question or two. So what are you waiting for? Come on over to www.patreon.com/murdermostirish and join in the fun for only €6 a month.
Give my mommy €6.
How did you get into kind of not even punk, but just music in general? Was it like your family, was your home full of music, or were you just your own kind of thing?
I laugh only because my family had no interest in music whatsoever. They were like the whitest family in America. But having said that, I mean, there was like, there was a record player in the house, and I do remember records like Linda Ronstadt and Herb Alpert and records like that, Carly Simon. But then I realized later that like all these records that were in the house were bought by my father, most likely based on the cover art. So so it's kind of gross. So
he was like, I like how that lady looks, let's buy this.
I think so, yeah. Yeah.
So how did you get into punk then, if that was your
kind of thing? I've asked myself that so many times. I think it was just, I think it's, so two things. So I think it was that thing that, you know, everybody says when they discover punk rock, which is, you know, they felt alienated. They didn't know where they belong. They were looking for their tribe and all that. And I wasn't aware of any of those things. I didn't know that I was looking for those things.
Yeah.
At the time. But my best friend's older sister, who I had a mad crush on, was into all of the DC punk stuff. And so my best friend at the time, this is when I was 12. So we were in elementary school. So he's like, you got to check out this band called the Dead Kennedys. I was like, Dead Kennedys, what the? And and so my initial response as a 12-year-old boy was just loving the fact that this band was like loud and aggressive and using curse words.
Yeah.
You know, right. Like, I've never heard that before. This is awesome. So then, then I dug a little deeper and realized, okay, well, this is, you know, it's just part of this genre. It's, you know, so anyway, so I remember his sister sat me down. She's like, you want to get into punk, this punk stuff? Like you really want to do this? Let me show you. Sit down. Let me play you what you need to hear. And I remember the first record she played was, this would have been probably the spring of, no, let's see. So this would have been like maybe the winter of 83. And she said, you got to hear this band, Minor Threat. And she played me Out of Step. And I immediately was like, holy shit, this is so good. This is like catchy. It's like, I love that he's saying fuck every other word. And so, and then she played me the Scream album, Still Screaming. And then she played me Dead Kennedys, Fresh Fruit for Rotting Vegetables. And Holiday in Cambodia. And I just went like, I don't know what this is, but I'm connecting to it in a way that I have never connected to anything before.
So. And I think it's very cool, actually, that you say it was a girl that got you into this, because that's, I know Dave Grohl said the same thing. I think it was his cousin that got him into punk music. Probably.
Yes, you're right.
And, girl, and it's so strange because that actually doesn't happen very frequently, you know, so it's kind of cool that it was, obviously you had a crush on her, so you were like, yeah, I like this, I love this, but
I'll listen to whatever you want me to listen
whatever
to
whatever you say, but no, but it's amazing because it is that thing. I think there's a visceralness about it that you can't really explain. When you hear it, you're like, oh, okay, no, that's the thing that I've been looking for.
No, you just nailed it. I mean, it's hard to explain to folks that haven't had that experience, but and that's fine if they haven't. It's just that, you know, for me it was instantaneous, and it was like, I don't know what this is, but I need to know more.
Yeah.
And then I just, you know, before that, I'm one of those people that when I'm into something, I'm like all in.
Yeah.
So I read everything I can, I do the research. I do it all. So before that, it was like comic books or I don't know what the fuck it was. But then once I discovered this, I went, oh my God, and I need to know more. And that's when I started going to the local record stores and talking to just the guys behind the counter.
You're
only 12.
Like,
that's... I was 12. Yeah. They were, I think they were amused. And also probably because I was such a dork. So I knew, they knew that I knew like stupid information, you know, about a particular record. So I think there was like, maybe like, okay, this kid's not just some like, you know, tourist, you know, that's just like visiting punk for 2 months and he's gonna like, you know, because I could be like, yeah, it wasn't Yeah, this was recorded like, you know, Steve Albini did it or whatever, like Touch and Go. And I think it was, this is out of Ohio, right? You know, like just stupid stuff like that, you know.
So you would have like all the little factoids for them.
Yeah.
Oh my God, that's so sweet.
It's such a dork. Like, yeah. I think after a while of me showing up every weekend, they kind of went, okay. And the funny thing, of course, is that a lot of those people ended up being in pretty influential bands.
You had an in kind of almost instantaneously. You were in, like, so it was probably easy for you to kind of navigate the scene because you already knew these people. And
yeah, and they, yeah, that's correct. And they were telling me about shows. You got to go see this band, whatever.
Yeah.
And I'll never forget. There was a record store called Yesterday and Today. And first interview I ever did, I was 12 and I started a fanzine. See, this is what I mean. Like literally like 6 months before I discovered punk rock, 6 months later, I was like, I'm doing a fanzine. So think about how quickly I figured out that, you know, you could do a fanzine. And I didn't even know what a fanzine was 6 months prior. But then you become so immersed in the scene, you realize, oh, everyone does a fanzine.
Everyone's doing it.
Yeah, this is what you do. So anyway, the first interview I ever did was Ian MacKaye. So, and the funny thing is that I went into the record store he worked at and Skip, the owner, told me, you know, he's like, you know, I think I was buying a Minor Threat 7-inch, which I wish I still had because I could probably pay my mortgage.
Yeah.
But yeah. And he was like, you know, he works here on like Tuesdays and Thursdays. And at that point, I still hadn't fully wrapped my head around because like in my mind, I'm like, oh, you put a record out, you're making a living out of playing music.
That's your job. Yeah.
Right. Like that's your job. Like you're playing like to tens of thousands of people. Like I didn't know.
Yeah.
You know, and so I was blown away. I was like, oh my God, I feel so bad. He has to work at a record store. You know, like I didn't. But anyway, so I went back. I don't know. I don't know how I got there. I don't remember. But I went back and I did my first interview with him. I'll never forget. It was with I had like a tape recorder and we did the interview at the cash register.
You still have the interview? Like, would you still have a recording?
I don't. I have a transcription of it. But I don't think, thank God I don't have the audio of it because the questions were horrible. Yeah, they were horrible.
No.
Yeah. Just
Was he nice to you though?
Like, he was super nice. Yeah. He was super nice. But he was, you know, Minor Threat had just broken up like a few months prior. So he was pretty down on what was going on in DC at the time. And so it was actually probably a really good time to interview him because he was so down on what was happening and had a lot of really interesting things to say about it. So,
yeah, because I read an interview or I listened to an interview you did where you talked about meeting Jim Sah for the first time and you were only 12 or 13 when you met him.
Yeah.
And then for that to happen and then for you years and years later to make a movie and him be involved in it, it's such a like an amazing thing that you still were in contact with him, that you still, and I think it's what I liked about it is it's almost you're still part of this little scene, like even though it's a bigger thing, it's still very DIY and you guys still all know each other and you want to help each other. So I just thought that was lovely.
Yeah, I mean, we still talk. What am I like? I don't want to age myself too much, but you know, almost 40 years. You know, so and we still talk and we still help each other out. And he, you know, he shot some stuff for the new film I'm doing.
Yeah.
He shot some stuff for the last film I did about Cream Magazine. So no, we've gone through a lot together and it's funny because a lot of the people that I still consider friends are people that, you know, we had this shared experience with from back then. So
and did he do anything for Harp magazine? I know that you were involved in, you were the editor of Harp.
He did. I was the editor and the art director, and so I hire him to do photo shoots occasionally. Yeah. So he did some for that magazine. We tended to go with, I worked with a ton of photographers on that magazine. I was really proud to have worked with some really great folks, great photographers, and Jim was certainly one of them. So it's just been like, and I remember I got laid off years ago. This was probably, what is this? It's probably like 15 years ago. I remember I got laid off from my job, and he hooked me up with a job where he worked for like 6 months. So it's just been this continual thing, you know?
Yeah. And when Harp finished, when it went out of publication, was it then that you decided you wanted to start making documentaries, or had that always been something you wanted to do and kind of in the background?
I always knew that I wanted to, I've always been a writer. That's what, and an editor. Yeah. So I thought for a long time about making a book, and I thought it could be told from my perspective, my POV. I hate that phrase. Because I thought that would make it different, young kid coming of age. These are the things I saw. These are the things I experienced. So I always had that in the back of my mind. And then when I was doing the magazine, that's all I ever wanted to do. Like from when I was 12, I always wanted to run a magazine, like a slick, professional mag. And 2001, I started Harp, and it was like a combination of, it was punk rock, but it was also like alt country, and it was like, but it covered a lot of music, just because that was a reflection of my my taste. Yeah, and I'm still like that. I'm like all over the map, but I always made sure that you could sort of connect the dots back somehow to punk rock.
Yeah.
And those were the happiest. I mean, I did that for 7 years, and it was a very successful magazine for 7 years. And then
I remember it.
Oh, you do?
I do. Yeah. I remember Harp. Yeah, I do. Oh. I remember the one cover that I really remember from Harp. You guys did a Ween cover.
Yes.
And it's the
I
one.
Love that.
Found it in my mom's garage last year because I was cleaning out my mom's garage.
Yeah.
I used to get it from I grew up in a tiny little town in Ireland, and there was a news agents down the road for me, and they'd order in magazines for me from the States. And I used to order that one. And then I was obsessed with the X-Files. So I used to order the X-Files magazines, and they were the two that I would all. Yes.
I love that.
So then I only kind of can, when I watched Salad Days, I only connected the dots that you were part of Harp. I was like, what the hell? So it kind of all made sense then, to be honest. I was like, okay, this makes total sense. But with regards Salad Days, with regards to the documentary, how did that come about? Did you feel like people were eager to be involved immediately, or did you kind of have to coax people? Or
I remember saying to Jim, I'd never done a documentary. I remember saying to Jim, we're going to make a documentary about the DC punk scene, and it's going to be honest, and it's going to be warts and all. And because I had, as a kid, I had this, like, I hung out with a lot of bands, and I didn't just hang out with them like in their, I hung out with them in their van and before they played, but I also hung out with them at their group houses. Every band had like a group house. So I would hear a lot of how these bands felt about what was going on in DC. And those are things that aren't discussed. They just aren't. They're not part of the DC sort of story. And I certainly wasn't trying to piss anyone off or anything, but I did want to show that it was not kumbaya. I was like, you know, there was like a lot of bands that were like, wait, why are we not on this bill? Like, and so it was interesting to me to show the sort of exclusionary factor that took place at a certain time within that scene. And yeah. I don't blame any, I mean, you know, it's a long time ago. But you know, at that, in that moment in time, there was, as someone says in the film, you know, there was like, you were cool or you weren't cool. And so I watched that firsthand and heard what the bands had to say. And, you know, they were really hurt, you know, really upset by it. So, but anyway, so I wanted to capture all of that, but in a look, I'm from DC, so I wanted to make it as diplomatic as possible without, you know, ruffling too many feathers. But I had no idea if I could do a doc. I'd never done one before, but I'd watched a million of them and I knew what I liked and what I didn't like. And I was really proud of the way that it turned out. And I had no clue. I thought, well, maybe I can get like one screening in DC and a few people might like it. And then I don't know what it'll happen. I don't know what'll happen after that.
Yeah.
And it just took on a life of its own and played all over the world. It played so many film festivals and just, I don't want to toot my horn, but sold out like everything from like Brazil to Germany to Berlin to Argentina and, you know, places in America. It was like, I did not see this coming, you know.
But I think it's testament to how huge that scene was to people, but it's also testament to the fact that you made a movie that looked beautiful. Like that documentary it looks like, you were just saying you wanted to make a glossy magazine when you were younger, like a high-end glossy magazine. That's what your documentary looks like. It looks like you're opening a really beautiful magazine that you get once a year. That's why I took to it so much, I think, because a lot of punk documentaries, not to talk badly about anybody, but they're in a way that is very DIY, kind of the way the music is. You know, Decline of Western Civilization is a phenomenal film.
Sure.
But it's very dirty. It's just dirty, but yours doesn't. And I just thought it was so different and so unique. So I think that's why a lot of people took to it.
Thank you.
So toot your own horn, toot away.
It's interesting that you mentioned Decline, because that's the one film. When I started, I said, you know, the DC scene, and this is what I wanted to establish pretty early on, was not nihilistic.
No.
And I felt like that was almost like had become a cliche in so many punk rock docs. And maybe in LA, well, clearly in LA, it was nihilistic. And I get that. But in DC, that was not what was happening. I challenge anyone to find music, maybe a song or two. But for the most part, what was going on in DC was not nihilistic. And so to me, it was like, I always saw DC as kind of a central character in the film. The geographical location, the fact that a lot of these folks, like you don't see it in the film, but if you know them, a lot of them are children of very powerful lobbyists, Washington insiders, politicians. And I was always curious how that informed their punk rock. And, you know, it's like, take, for example, I've said this before, but like, and not everyone gets it, but at that time, a band like Rites of Spring, one of the, in my opinion, one of the greatest bands
ever.
And I was fortunate enough to see them. And I'll never forget it. But anyway, I remember Brendan, the drummer, telling me, I wouldn't have known this because, you know, I wasn't that fancy. But he told me that Rites of Spring was, now I'm going to forget the composer, I think it's Stravinsky.
Okay.
Rites of Spring was a song, or a, I'm sorry, a composition, whatever you call it in classical music, by, I think, Stravinsky. And the first time it ever played in Europe, the crowd went nuts. It was a, there was a riot. People were hurt. The police had to come in. Yeah. So, but think about that for a second. It's like, what other punk rock bands would be thinking about a classical piece of music to use as their name?
Yeah. And I think there's we're just saying there that, like, the difference between DC and LA, the thing about DC, even with Minor Threat, they were a band that were like, don't die, stay alive.
Exactly.
A hope within that, that kind of, and then obviously that question has to be asked, you know, if people grow up with money, do they see life as a more hopeful thing? So it is like, anthropologically, you're kind of like, oh, this makes so much sense that this is the difference between bands in LA and bands in Washington, D.C.
Exactly.
But that's crazy about Rites of Spring. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Full-blown pit at, like, Stravinsky, killing each other.
I know, right? Yeah. I could be wrong about the composer. I'm pretty sure it's, but regardless, it was a classical piece of music. Yeah. And so that, to me, was always, like, stood out for me, because I went, like, you know, when you're in, you know, 1985 and you've got like Reagan Youth, Wasted Youth,
yeah,
you know, MDC, I don't know, the list goes on. they certainly weren't, you know, so that's, to me, spoke to their upbringing, spoke to the fact that they probably heard that music in their household at some point. Yeah. And that's not something that was happening around the country. So I was always fascinated by, to me, like I said, to me, the geography always, I felt I want, or at the very least, I wanted to explore what effect the geography had on the music and had on the musicians. So.
Well, you did a really good job of that, because it really stood out to me very, very much within the documentary. So actually, I just wanted to mention, you mentioned that you wanted to show kind of the warts and all side of things. I was really impressed that you touched on kind of the misogyny within the scene and this idea of like toxic masculinity, where it was like, if you were kind of less, if you were more emotional, you were seen as kind of a nerd and a weirdo and you weren't cool, because that can kind of be ignored a lot within that music, because it is so heavy and it is so fast and it is so hard that people presume that everybody is just, you know, angry and nihilistic. But yeah, no, that was one thing when I watched it, I did tell a couple of my female friends, like, definitely watch this because it's not ignored. So I just wanted to say thank you for putting that in, because sometimes people don't. So and to mention female bands as well and put them centered in it as well was really, really, really good. So.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, I remember hearing things firsthand. I didn't mention it in the film, but there's a scene in the film where Monica is, there's a character, her name's, oh God, I'm drawing a blank. Monica from a band called Madhouse. And she talks about, and I was at this show, and she talked about a song about rape. And I was surrounded by, I remember I was in the middle of the, it was packed. It was a Circle Jerk show, I think. I could be wrong, but it was, I know it was Marginal Man. It was packed. It was like 800 people. Anyway, she talks about this song and she said it's about rape. And you had people in the audience saying, show me your tits. You know, show me your, and it was so antithetical. It was so like, I couldn't wrap my head around what was going on, but you had so many moronic skinhead types that were there. And you know, kudos to her to have that. I mean, that's incredibly brave to yeah. talk about that. And, she didn't back down and she sang the song. And, but you know, that was the other thing I wanted to kind of not expose, but just show that, like, you know, as much as maybe we all want to think that DC was, you know, this sort of intellectual, like, whatever, that stuff existed, you know, and, you know, was very much a part of what was going on. You know, I remember people saying, like, oh, yeah, she's not a bad guitar player for a chick. You know, I mean, just, you know, I had these, you know, and there's also things I heard at the time that were racist, you know, that were along the same lines, like, oh, he's not bad for, you know. So those were all things. That's all stuff that I remembered. And I, you know, I just felt like I'd be not being truthful if I didn't include those things, yeah. because, you know, that was really what was going on. DC was not, probably not unlike a lot of scenes, but I think, but, you know, but I think probably, and you know, I don't want to, you know, offend anybody, but, you know, really smart people. I mean, these are really smart kids that were really, for you know, 40, whatever it was.
It's that kind of thing where, you know, you can have a million smart people in a room and smartness does not eradicate prejudice, unfortunately. Sometimes it can heighten it. It can make people sound more intelligent when they're being racist or homophobic or misogynistic. So it's almost like they use it as a skill, which can be really bothersome. So I totally understand what you mean by that. But also, I just wanted to ask, with regards to the 10th anniversary, was there anything, you're obviously adding new bits and pieces in for the 10th anniversary. Was there anything that you, at the time when you made the movie, was there anything that you had really wanted to put in that you couldn't put in? Or was there any interviews you did that you were like, I can't put that into the movie?
Okay, there were two or three interviews that I decided not to use at all. Because, well, one, there was this band, it's a very obscure band, but in DC they were something, you know, and because they were unlike any other band, they were, I don't even know how to describe them. They weren't punk rock, and yet they were, but it was like, how do I describe them? It was like very catchy, very like, it was like new wave punk kind of stuff. And they were a band, you know what? It's 10 years later. They were a band called 9353. And they were very sort of enigmatic because you would see their flyers everywhere. And their flyers were very distinctive. And I saw them several times, and a number of the band's members had drug issues. So when I interviewed the singer for the band, who is a character unlike anyone else I think I've met, Anyway, he told some great stories, you know, including like, you know, stealing jewelry from people in the front row, just taking, you know, women wearing really nice earrings or watches or rings and just taking them right off their wrist while they were playing and then selling them for heroin. So that was, I thought, an incredible interview. But he decided 2 years before the film was ever released, decided that I was making too much of a Discord-friendly film. And so he went all over social media and said, you know, I'm not a part of this thing. I'm going to fucking, you know, punch this guy if I ever see him, which is fine, but maybe you could have waited until the film was done, because if you had waited, you would have seen that I would have included these scenes and shown, you know, that, you know, this was what was happening. Yeah. I wasn't afraid to do it. The other story, and I don't want to, you know, again, disparage, but I did interview HR for a number of people over the years have asked me, why is there not more Bad Brains stuff, like Bad Brains interviews, you know, members like Dr. No or HR or Daryl. And I'll be totally honest. Each band member wanted to be paid to the interview. And so I guess me just coming from an editorial background, that's not something I agree with. So I said, okay, well, thank you, but no thanks. And then when I did interview HR, it was not an interview that I wanted I didn't think it was fair to him to be represented in the way that he did the interview.
Okay.
It was not coherent.
Was he already suffering? Was he already going through his illness at that point?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay, I understand.
So so people, you know, that's an ongoing question I get, but I try to be diplomatic, but the truth is like, I love that band and I didn't want to show them in a light that it's just, you know, they don't deserve to be looked at or remembered that way. And I just wasn't comfortable paying for an interview. That's just, has nothing to do with budget. It's just like,
changes the dynamic of what exactly thing is. It becomes about money, and then money changes how people talk, and it's a really murky area. So
it is. So I just,
you know, even with the documentary, there are so many bands in that documentary that have, so many bands have been created from them. Like, so many bands have come from that. Like, I know at the moment Turnstile are so huge, like they are massive at the moment. And they are, you just listen to them and you're like, you can hear that they listen to the Bad Brains constantly. Right. And to like Naked Ray Gone and to those bands that, you know, are big to us, are huge to us.
Right.
Not huge to like, my sister wouldn't know who that is. You know what I mean? And then these other bands are coming out of that are playing stadiums and selling out world tours. And it's just an odd dichotomy to watch.
It is.
But yeah, just seeing with Salad Days, just being like, these, like, I know people who wouldn't know who any of these people are, and I don't mean that in like, oh my god, I know who these people are, I just mean they wouldn't know who these artists are.
Yeah.
Yet they would know these other bands who sound like these artists.
Right. No, it's true.
It's true.
I mean, I try to make it in a way where even if you had no clue about any of this shit, that it's kind of like when you're flipping channels, you know, on streaming or you're on Netflix or you're whatever, and you're just flipping channels and all of a sudden you land on some dock that's like so fucking weird you don't understand, but you just start watching it. That was kind of my hope, is like, I think these characters and these personalities are strong enough that even if you don't know or hate the music, you can relate to, I hope, what they were trying to accomplish, you know.
Of course. No, well, you did a phenomenal job at that. And I'm not just blowing smoke up your ass. I promise. Like, genuinely.
I don't mind.
You don't mind?
I don't mind.
It's like on my Instagram, I had a post from like the month after the movie came out.
Really? 10 years like, ago?
Yeah. And I remember I went back and I was like, that's crazy. Cause that I was so hyped on that movie, like so hyped on your movie. I was just like, I cannot wait for this. And it didn't in any capacity. Like, so I'm so excited for people that haven't seen it to come see it in October. And I hope I have people coming to it that know nothing about it and are just coming to support me. So my hope is that they watch it and then they kind of go seek out these bands and get into it. But I just wanted to ask you one final thing. Like, those pictures of you when you were so little, like when you were 12 years old, like because I've seen pictures of Harley Flanagan from Chrome.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It was kind of like that. Yeah.
It was exactly like when I saw those pictures of you, I was like, this is a Harley Flanagan thing where it's like, why were you in these buildings? How did you get into these buildings? What was going on? But you were in the middle of like a massive thing that maybe people didn't realize how massive it was. And I don't know if you've read Viv Albertine's book from The Slits. She has.
Yes.
Great book. But there's a part in that book where she wrote that it kind of, because for me, I'm such a huge punk music fan and a hardcore fan that for me, these scenes are like so amazing and so much was going on and so much was happening and all these life changing things were happening. But she said in the book, a lot of people didn't understand that these things were happening, but everything, we were just waiting for things. Like, you were waiting for shows, you were waiting for a train show. So to you, it was happening around you. You didn't really even think of it as this huge. Did you feel like that, or did you know, oh, this is something that's going to change music, it's going to change a lot of people?
No, I didn't. I was not that self-aware or whatever. Like, but I did know what it meant for me. And I remember, I thankfully had a lot of friends who were older than me, and they would drive me home, you know, after the show. And I remember those rides home being so depressing for me, because I was always sad, because it was like, okay, when's the next show? When's the next show? It's a week. Okay, great. I can do a week. 3 weeks. God damn, I gotta wait 3 weeks to feel this kind of adrenaline and this sort of endorphin. Like, it was, you know, I think I was like an 80. Well, I was like an ADHD kid, so it was like when you discover something like that, you can't get enough, and I was just, yeah. I couldn't wait for the next one. And it was hard because my parents had split. So I was living with my mother, and to her credit, she was, very good about letting me go out. Some would argue perhaps that she was maybe too good. You know, I would sometimes come home at 1 or 2 in the morning. But I think, you know, she told me years later, like, that was the only thing I'd ever seen you be passionate about. And I didn't want to crush that. So, yeah. So, but yeah, I whether I knew I was a part of something that was going to be huge, that's a tough question. I don't think I thought that. Like, even now, I'm not like, you know, oh, like when I make a movie, I'm like, well, hopefully maybe 1 or 2 people will watch it. Like, I'm not Like, yeah. I don't, you know, I don't think of it like that. But I will say, when I saw bands like Rites of Spring or Embrace, where you, and once again, this is a DC thing. I mean, I challenge, and I have many friends in Boston, in Chicago, whatever, but I challenge them to tell me a band where, when the set was over, people were throwing bouquets of flowers on the stage. Okay. Flowers.
That's crazy.
I mean, that's not, well, actually, looking back now, that's very punk rock. But at the time, at the time, it was like, what the fuck is this? But when Rites of Spring were over, well, first of all, Rites of Spring, by the end of their set, there'd be nothing left. Which always pissed me off, because Guy Picciotto had, like, such great guitars. And, like, you know, he had a Rickenbacker, he had, like, a Gibson Les Paul Jr., and he'd just end up fucking just smashing the neck, just breaking the neck off and whatever. And I just remember thinking, like, hey, before you do that, I'm happy to take that guitar for you.
Take it home.
I'll take it home. I'll take good care of it. You don't need to smash it. But but yeah, bouquets of flowers were thrown up on the stage. And that's like, when I think of that, that's like Morrissey or something. Like, just going to say. Right? This is
anything even close to what that is, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
And so that's what was interesting. Going back to what I said about record stores. So these guys, like Brendan from Fugazi or Guy Picciotto or Mike Hampton, any of these folks from these bands back then, we would be like, check this band out. And they'd play me like the Chameleons, or they'd play me, you know, the Cult or Mission UK. These were not hardcore bands, or the Church. They loved the Church.
Yeah.
And so I had this early sense of melody and of, you know, songwriting.
Yeah.
I always found that fascinating to me because, again, you know, these were folks, you know, they weren't thinking about the next, they couldn't give a fuck. Am I allowed to cuss? Sorry.
Yeah.
Oh, good. Okay.
Go ahead. It's not a problem.
Okay, great. They couldn't give a fuck about the next, you know, SSD Control record. You know, that's not what, you know, they were listening to, you know, the Chameleons and the Smiths and, you know, all this great Britpop that was going on that was phenomenal. Felt was another band. I remember them playing me. So I always felt like, you know, there were really big differences between DC and the rest of the country. I mean, I was kind of gambling to an extent, because I never spent time in any other city. I didn't know.
Yeah.
But I did, you know, reading scene reports and looking at the bands coming out of those cities. I was like, there's never a macho thing. You know, every other city, it was like macho, like, you know, bullshit, like dudes with, you know, six packs. And it was like, what does that have to do with, you know? So DC was not like that. There was not a single person with a six pack, I promise you. You know, except me.
Books.
I had one, but
I believe that.
Well, don't. Yeah.
No, but I won't keep you much longer. I just wanted to.
I'm fine.
Thank you so much for talking to me. We've sold a lot of tickets.
Have you?
Yes. People are being so kind. And I didn't even know what this was, this company called Liquid Death. And
what?
Yeah, people are being, so this is what I mean. Like, this movie is, I know we're only a tiny little country, but like, our scenes are so small that
you're
so important. Like, you've no idea how much people love this film. So,
Are you serious?
Like, it's crazy.
If you're lying, I don't mind.
No, I swear to God, like, people are reaching out to me. Like, I'm mentioning it once and then I have people reaching out to me because of the film. Like, it's nothing to do with me or my podcast or anything else. It's because of the film. So, you know, people love it. So I hope you know that just from, like, our little country that doesn't get much love. We do absolutely adore it. So thank you.
My God, that's huge. I've never, if you can believe it, never been to Ireland. My mother, Jesus Christ. My wife has dual citizenship.
You were saying.
Yeah, right.
Oh, actually, before we go, I wanted to ask you about your new movie, if that's okay.
So I'm working on my third doc. It's called Something Better Change. And it's about Joe Keithley. If you're not familiar with Joe Keithley, he was the, or is, the singer and main songwriter for a band called DOA. DOA, if you know, remember back in the 80s, it was DOA, Black Flag, Minor Threat, Dead Kennedys. Those were kind of the big four. And DOA created, like, the roadmap for those bands to tour the country. And I was a huge fan as a kid. And those guys always put politics and activism first. And were always very, vocal from the stage about, you know, whatever was happening at the time. And so fast forward, 35 years, whatever it's been. And Joe Keithley is still in DOA. They just played Riot Fest in Chicago to a packed crowd. He was elected council member in 2018. And once I saw that story of this guy that I had admired for so long, I went, well, fuck, there's some hope. I know it's not America, it's Canada, but there's hope. And so I decided, let's make a doc and follow him through the 2022 election.
Oh, wow. You know,
4 years in office. And let's see if he, and win or lose, that's the film.
Yeah.
So that's what we did. And I'm really proud of it. I think it's really a beautiful film. And, you know, there's everyone from, like, you know, Ian MacKay to Duff McKagan to Beto O'Rourke to Jello Biafra. They're all in the film. But it's, yeah, but it's ultimately about him and his sort of DIY approach to campaigning.
Yeah.
And so I thought that would make for sort of a compelling, like, story. Like, what, you know, does he win? Does he lose? Who knows? So that is premiering at the Woodstock Film Festival October 11th. And then that will be, that's in upstate New York. And then we'll be followed by Sound Unseen in Minneapolis. And then the following week, we're doing a screening at a place called The Grand Illusion in Seattle, where it'll be Duff McKagan, me, and Joey doing a panel and possibly Duff and Duff's band and Joe playing a song. So
that's amazing.
Yeah.
Dude, so. Congratulations. That's incredible. Seriously, I'm so excited about that movie. I'm so excited to see it. So and I think it's such an interesting thing because when especially musicians or especially punk musicians get into politics, obviously people would have that kind of thing where they would think, well, like you're not meant to be into politics. And, you know, but it's so fascinating that he's done that and he's done a good job. So,
yeah.
I'm excited.
Yeah. I mean, that's, you know, it's like, especially now, and we planned it to come out during election season. We wanted people to see that, you know, if you're able to do this on a DIY level against all odds, I mean, his opponents had like six-figure budgets and he had like, you know, $20,000-$30,000 budget. And
it's in his blood though, isn't it? Like when you can do that stuff as a young person and you learn how to market yourself.
Yeah.
It stands to you as you get older.
Exactly. And yeah. So what I was trying to show is that the punk rock base or sort of the, you know, foundation serves him later in life to win or not win this new election. And so, yeah, I mean, it's someone asked me the other day, like, what is the theme through all your films? And I'm like, my first thought was like, I don't know what the fuck you're talking about. Like, I don't. Yeah, I don't have a theme. But then I realized, you know what? I thought about it for a minute and I went, well, every film is ultimately at the end of the day is like an underdog story. So let's start with Saladay's. Saladay's, in theory, like there never should have been a successful music scene in DC. There was no infrastructure. There were no labels. There were no nothing. There was no, the clubs sucked. Like, and yet they made something out of nothing. Cream Magazine, which is, you know, informed my writing over the years. In fact, when I was doing Harp, if you look at the masthead, my senior editor was Jan Huelski, who is also the senior editor for Cream. But that magazine should never have been successful.
Yeah.
It was like from Detroit with guys that didn't know what the fuck they were, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, writers and just staff in general that didn't know what the fuck they were doing, and yet they became the number two to Rolling Stone. And now here we are with this one where there's a guy that, you know, has never, you know, I don't think ever even graduated from college, but, you know, has a vision, has an agenda, and has a background of 40 years of activism.
Yeah.
And, you know, so they're all sort of underdog stories.
I think as well, are you like a hopeful person? Do you think you're a hopeful person? Sometimes we can be very cynical and a lot of documentaries are based in cynicism, but yours always has that little stream of like hope going through it. So do you think you as a person are like that or no?
That's a really, really great question. I always try to, and when you see the film, like every film, you know, I always try to show that, yeah, you're right. You nailed it. Like, that there is hope. And what that hope looks like, form it takes, what, you know, who knows? But, you know, it was like with Salad Days, one of my favorite parts of that film is the 8mm stuff at the end that I found very, like, we were done with the film, and then I got that footage, and I went, oh my God, this is going to be an amazing ending. So, because you're seeing the people that you've seen throughout the film, and now you're seeing them come for a full circle where they're either, you know, carrying instruments to the stage, or they're dancing, or they're whatever. It was like, there's hope. Like, this is like, it's not, you know, there's no, I didn't want it to end on a cynical note. I wanted it to end on, because all, again, not to get too heavy, but to me, and Mark Anderson says it in the film, but I tried to back up what he said, was Salad Days isn't in the past. Salad Days is now, and it can always be now. And so a lot of people don't understand what Salad Days is, which is fine. But Salad Days is actually a Shakespearean term that means you, someone at the height of their creative abilities, creative powers. And so the salad part of that phrase comes from being green, because you're new and you're discovering this stuff.
Yeah.
But what I maintain is that you don't have to be 17, you know, to feel that way. You can be 50.
Yeah. I think one of the things I dislike most in the world is people being jaded. I hate jadedness. And I see it a lot in music, and I see it a lot in films, and I see it a lot in people who get a lot of success and then just start hating what they do. And you can feel it. But obviously, I've seen Salad Days, I've seen the Cream documentary, and I've never felt that. I felt like this, you needed to make this. That's how I felt. Like, it was something that needed to be done. So if anything stands, it's that. There's no, nobody's jaded. Nobody is like, oh, just get it out. We have to put it out. So I'm really excited about the new documentary, because I know it's going to be the exact same thing. It's just going to be necessary. So, yeah.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah.
Thank you. I had so much fun talking to you. I'm so glad I got to speak to you.
Me too. It's not often that I have this, you know, an interview that's good. And you ask great questions. And
But yeah, enjoy the rest of your evening, whatever you're
doing.
Thank
you. Take care.
Bye.
I was doing next to nothing about a year ago, but Sarah Jane and Emma came and knocking on my door. Said they figured out a better way to pass the time and do a little podcast, researching through crime. They wanted hoodies, cats and bees, the kind of place where men are not allowed. They wanted hoodies, cats and bees. On Sunday night, Sarah Jane would come around, lay a story down. And just about when everything was going as planned, Sarah Jane and Emma started making demands. You're gonna have to edit out for what we said, so it'll only record if we're sitting on a bed. Ooh, these cats and bees, well, a lifetime supply of Jenny Glow. They won't. Homicide, some Army Hammer Joes, and a song to end the show.